Welcome to the podcast of Focus 580, featuring interviews with newsmakers and experts on international affairs and daily life, hosted by David Inge at WILL Radio, Urbana, Illinois. Please support this service by becoming a member and visit us on the web at will.uiuc.edu.
This is Focus 580, the second hour of a program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. The producers for the show, Harriet Williamson and Martha Deal, and Jason Croft is at the controls this morning. In this hour of Focus 580, we'll be talking with novelist Ernest Gaines. A lot of people will know him for his novel A Lesson Before Dying that was published in 1993. It sold very well, has been very highly regarded. It was nominated for a Pulitzer Prize. It won the Best Fiction Award of the National Book Critics Circle in 1994, also won awards from the Southern Writers Conference and the Louisiana Library Association. It was chosen by Oprah Winfrey as a book in her book club back in 1997. It also was made into a TV movie by HBO in 1999 and received two Emmy Awards for the work. He has authored a number of other books, and perhaps next to A Lesson Before Dying, his next best-known book is The Autobiography of Miss Jane Pittman, which was really his first big commercial success. It was published in 1971. It was also made into a made-for-television movie that won 9 Emmy Awards. He has won many awards for his work over his career, including one of the highest honors that the United States offers, that is the National Humanities Medal. He received that award from President Bill Clinton in December of 2000. He will be here in Champaign, Urbana to talk about his writing and about A Lesson Before Dying. This will be next week, next Wednesday. It's part of a series that is being jointly sponsored by the Champaign Public Library and also Parkland College that they're calling Literary Legends. And there will be 3 writers. Mr. Gaines is the first. The second will be Walter Mosley. He'll be here in May. And then Sherman Alexie. He'll be here in June. And having said all that, I have to say that if you don't already have your tickets to see Ernest Gaines, they're already all spoken for. However, according to the Champaign Public Library, there is a waiting list, and you can call them and get your name on the list. So if someone decides they have a ticket they can't use and they take it back to the library, there are people who are on that list who are waiting. Having said that, you do have an opportunity here this morning to hear from the guest and also to speak with him. He's been good enough to spend some time with us here, and he is joining us by the telephone. Questions are welcome here on the show. The number, if you're here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line, and that one is good anywhere that you can hear us, around Illinois, Indiana. In fact, since we're on the Internet, if you would happen to be listening anywhere in the United States, you may also use the toll-free line, and that is 800-222-9455. 333-WILL and toll-free 800-222-WILL. Those are the numbers. Mr. Gaines, hello.
Hello.
Thank you for talking with us.
Thank you, sir.
And we certainly appreciate you giving us some of your time. Mm-hmm. I thought I might begin, since your writing is all, I think, set, all the stories are set in the place where you grew up, or at least where you had your childhood and a lot of your teenage years, in Louisiana. And I wonder if you could just talk a little bit about what it was like when you were a boy there in Louisiana, and that this would have been, you were born in the 30s, so this would have been certainly well before the civil rights era and well before World War II. What was life like there when you were a boy? Well,
I was born in 1933, January 19, 1933, and I was born on a plantation, primarily sugarcane, but there was cotton and corn. And I went into the fields as a small child, 8 years old, to pick cotton. And I attended a school on the plantation quarters. It was not really a school, but a church. And we had a school in that church about, between 5.5 and 6 months out of the year, maybe closer to 5.5 months out of the year, because all the children were sent into the fields to plant the what was necessary to be planted and the harvest. What was necessary to be harvested, and school sort of set it after you had, you know, attended the fields and before you had to go into harvesting the crops. So, I, along with all the other children who grew up on that plantation, we all did the same work. I was nothing unique about myself. We all did the same work.
Mm-hmm. And as I understand, you may be tired of recounting these details of your life, but so you'll have to forgive me. But as I understand that, your parents left. They went to California. They went looking for work, and you stayed behind at least for some of those years, and you lived with an aunt.
Right. Well, my folks went there during the war, and then they sent for me after the war, 1948. I went to California because there was no high school that I could attend here in the parish where I lived here in Louisiana. There were no high school for black children at the time. And so my folks sent for me to bring me to California to attend school. But I've been living with my aunt, who was crippled all the time that my folks had been gone. And when I left other brothers and sisters here with them. And each time one of us would reach the age of finish the elementary school, the folks would my folks would bring us up to California to attend high school.
Mm-hmm. And this was the first time, your first experience when you went to California when you were 15 years old. This was your first experience with a public library.
Absolutely, because I could not attend the library here either. And I went into a library, in Andrew Carnegie Library in Vallejo, California. Vallejo was a small town. Just northeast, I think, of San Francisco, about 30-some miles northeast of San Francisco. And I went into that library. I went into a library for the first time. And then I just discovered books and just began to read and read and read. And I suppose I was trying to find myself in those books, but at that time, this would be 48, 49, there were no books in those libraries about blacks, by or about blacks, and those small libraries at that time. Those libraries are small towns, I should say, at that time.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, I read. I just read and read, and then I tried to write. I remember after I'd written the autobiography of Miss Jane Pittman, an interviewer from Reader's Digest asked me which book in that library had influenced me most. And when I could not come up with an answer, he told me that, well, maybe it was the book that was not there, and you felt that you had to put it on the shelf. So I said, maybe that's the answer.
Yeah, that's a great, that's a wonderful thought, and it doesn't indeed sound as if that was the thing that set you on the course to being a writer. That is, you were devouring all these books, and there were a lot of wonderful books. Nothing, you know, nothing against Tolstoy and people like that, but that you felt that there were no stories that the stories of you, your stories, and your people's stories weren't there. And it's my impression that really was what motivated you to write, because you wanted to write those stories.
Right. Well, you know, before I went to California, I used to write letters for the old people on that plantation because none of those people had gone to school. And so I'd write their letters and read their letters for them. So my apprenticeship as a writer may have began at that time, you know, back in the, when I was a child of 12 or 13 years old, because I had to write all these people, their letters for them. And I had to create the letters for them because they didn't know how to, you know, finish off a letter. They could open the letter, but they did not finish it off. So I had to learn to do things like that for them, which I did. And then when I went to California, when I tried to write, I was trying to recall those sort of things that I used to write about in Louisiana. I always wanted to write about Louisiana, and I suppose those trying to repeat those letters of the experience of those people in my fiction, which I'd done in their letters.
Yeah. And I think that I also read you said something to the effect that you, as I mentioned, so many of your stories are set in the place where you grow up,
mm-hmm.
and that you perhaps had tried to write other kinds of things, and it just somehow didn't work out. So perhaps that's the reason why the stories are based so much in your, initially at least, based in your personal experience.
Oh, yes. I tried to write different stories. I tried to write, I was in the military, so I tried to write stories about my army life, and I lived in San Francisco most of my young man, from age from 20 to, 22 to 40, 50, and I tried to write about my my experience in San Francisco, my bohemian period in San Francisco. I tried to write ghost stories. I tried to write all kinds of things, but nothing came true to me as my Louisiana stories.
Yeah.
I've often told people that I my body went to California in 1948, but the soul stayed here. Stayed here in Louisiana.
Our guest is Ernest J. Gaines. He is the author of the novel A Lesson Before Dying, a book that received the National Book Critics Circle Award for Fiction. That was in when it was published back in, was 1993. Is that right?
It was published in 1993. The award was in
1994. It was in 1994. Mm-hmm. And so many people will know him for this book, which has received a lot of awards and a lot of recognition. And back in 1997, became a choice of Oprah Winfrey's book club. Also, the other book, perhaps if you know his name, you know him for the book The Autobiography of Miss Jane Pittman. Both of these were made into films for television, very well received. And he is the author of a number of other books as well. His most recent is a collection of stories, which is entitled Mozart and Leadbelly, and that was published by Knopf last fall. So that is out there. All of his work is certainly available. If you go down to the bookstore, you go down to the library, you can find it. And as I mentioned at the beginning of the program, he'll be here in Champaign-Urbana to give a talk about his writing and specifically about A Lesson Before Dying, sponsored by the Public Library, Champaign Public Library, and Parkland College. And also, as I mentioned, if you're just hearing about this for the first time and you'd like to go, I'm sorry to report that the tickets are all spoken for. But there will be two other writers in this series who will also be speaking. And if we're lucky, we can have him here on the program as well, Walter Mosley and Sherman Alexie. So that's another opportunity to hear from some of these writers. It's a program, a series that they're calling Literary Legends, and there'll be one this month and one in May and one in June. So for more information, you can go to the website of the Champaign Public Library. And here on the program, of course, questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. I expected probably there would be some people who are not familiar with the story, A Lesson Before Dying, and perhaps we could at least sketch out the basics of the plot a little bit. And it is the setting is the place where you grew up,
mm-hmm.
as we have discussed, and it's set in the 1940s. I believe. 1948.
Yes.
In Louisiana, where you grew up. And involves essentially mainly two characters. A young man who is mistakenly involved in a serious crime, is charged with murder, is found guilty, and is sentenced to die. And the man who is the teacher in this town sounds like the place you went to school.
Yes.
A school and a church.
Yes.
And he, much against his will initially, is recruited by the godmother of this young man who is sentenced to die to go and spend time with him in prison. And it all sort of resolves around the argument that the defense attorney makes for this man who is young man who is charged with murder. In the effort to get mercy for his client, he makes the most demeaning argument you possibly could, I'd think.
Yeah.
Essentially arguing that he should not be held responsible because he is less than human. And it's a sort of a stunning argument even to think about, and the way that it's presented is sort of brief, but that's really the key. Sort of the key thing that starts the whole story going and underpins the whole thing all the way through, that and the feeling of this woman, this the godmother of this young man, that's wrong, and that she just can't leave it like that, and doesn't want him to finish his life under that sort of burden. Perhaps let's go back and talk a little bit about that. How it is, particularly, you thought about using this as the point of departure for this story.
Well, you know, I've had nightmares a lot in my earlier manhood, middle age, and I lived in San Francisco for many years, over 40 years. And just across the bay from San Quentin, from Marin County in San Quentin. And whenever there was an execution, I would always have nightmares about this execution. And it went on for years, and I thought the only way that I could get rid of this sort of thing is to try to write about it. And so that's what I tried, as I started out. And then I started doing research on executions, and I read books about short stories and novels about executions. When I started writing my book, a colleague of mine at University of Louisiana in Lafayette, where I was teaching at the time, told me about a case that I might be interested in, and I read the case, and everything just came up in my mind how to put my book together,
mm-hmm.
And you know, that's what happened.
Well, when
I did a lot of research in Louisiana, I went to jails, and I talked to small town sheriffs, and I talked to jail keepers, wardens, lawyers, people who had experienced observed execution in here in Louisiana, small towns.
Mm-hmm.
Up until the 50s, execution in the state of Louisiana took place in the parish where the crime was committed. You didn't necessarily commit the execute a person in the jail. I mean, the penitentiary, Angola, but where the crime was committed. So I got into all this kind of information, and then I used my own personal background, the school, the church, the fields, the people I knew, and that's how I wrote the story.
Yeah, they apparently actually had a traveling electric chair. It was portable, and they would take it to where they wouldn't take the person to the electric chair. They'd take the electric chair to the person.
Right, right. And that happened. That went on until 1952, something like that, somewhere around that time.
When you say that you had nightmares about executions, and now I'm curious, did you have the nightmare that you were the person who was being executed?
I was sometimes it was me, and it was sometimes my brother, or sometimes my friends, or someone like that. And, sometimes it was me.
And this was just mostly because of your proximity to where the execution was taking place, do you think?
Right, yeah. I remember every Tuesday, the execution would take place on Tuesdays at 10 o'clock, Tuesday mornings at 10 o'clock. And I would get up earlier, and I could walk to the ocean from where I lived. I lived about 4.5 miles from there, from the ocean. And I would just put my watch aside, and I just walk and stay there until noonish or afternoon sometime. Then I walk back because I didn't want to be around time or papers or anything else. You know, and then I'd come on back home.
Mm.
And this whenever there was an execution there in that San Quentin.
Yeah, it just I guess now I'm starting to think about some of what has been written recently by people who obviously oppose the death penalty,
mm-hmm.
who make the argument that it goes to this question of what constitutes cruel and unusual punishment,
yeah.
That the experience of being on death row, what it does to the person is it, in a psychological, emotional sense, hollows them out bit by bit so that by the time you get around to executing the person, they're just almost, they're just a shell. They're not really a person anymore. Their essence is is gone.
I was listening to, there's a documentary now out about this young man, Willie Francis, who was executed in Louisiana, I think he's 17, 18 years old. And there was an interview with Sister Helen Prejean, and who wrote Men Walking, and she's saying the same thing. By the time an execution took place, you know, the man was already dead. He's been dead inside. So what they were executing was just, you know, the shell of a man, because he's already dead.
Yeah. The, as I mentioned here, the thing that starts this, starts the plot rolling is the this young man who Jefferson is his name, who accidentally, he sort of stumbles into this crime.
Yes.
Who is then charged with murder and sentenced to die. His defense attorney makes this argument. And ultimately, when it comes to, down to it, he says, "Now, I just don't. I would not want to see this person put in the electric chair." And as I say, it makes this ultimately this horrible argument that says it'd be like putting an animal into the electric chair,
putting a hog into the electric
chair. You know, and he's arguing that he is less than human. And and so what happens then is his godmother, she's the one who goes to Grant, who was the teacher, and says, "Look, I want you to go and I want you to talk with Jefferson, and I want you to spend some time with him, because I can't take the idea of him going to his death feeling like that, with that burden on him." That's just, and as I say, and Grant, the teacher, he doesn't want to have anything to do with it. It isn't initially. He says it's too, you know, he says, "Look, I can't deal with this. I got enough other problems." Although ultimately he does go. Why is it that to your character, Miss Emma, and then I suppose ultimately to you, because she is your character, you created her. Why is it so important for her that before he dies, that Jefferson has the opportunity at least to reconsider, to go through this transformation? Because that's really what this is all about for both these two characters. It's
right.
About transformation. Why is it so important to her?
Well, because no one had ever done anything for her. One of my themes in my work is, and my most of my writing is that, since the first war in this country, war for independence, black men have died, and yet when they came back from wars, from the first war to the, you know, the war in Iraq right now, they could go out and fight for this country, but when they came back home, they had no power, and they did very little, as Grant tells Vivian, they did very little for their womenfolk. And so Miss Emma, who never had anybody do anything for her, felt that she could not afford to let Jefferson die as a hog, as this lawyer had characterized him, but that he had to stand, and if he stand and do that for her, as well as for himself, but to do something for her before he died. That was her reason, but it's a story of those. Both Jefferson and Grant, because both of them are in need of help. Jefferson, of course, is to die within, you know, a few months, and Grant has to convince him that he's not what he described in that courtroom as an animal, as a hog, but that he's a human being. At the same time, Grant is running into place himself. He's not grounded yet. And he's teaching school, but he hates teaching school. He lives in the South, but he hates living in the South. He doesn't recognize any things around him, the religion or the any political ideas or anything around him. He's in love with a person, Vivian, but he would like to run away with her and get away from this place where he feels that no matter what he does, he will never do any good. Too much has happened that he cannot do any good. But between Miss Emma and his aunt Talu and Vivian, they keep him there. And through his going to Jefferson, back and forth from the jail to the from the school to the jail and the jail to the school, he also began to recognize responsibilities that he must. Well, Jefferson helps him as much as he helps Jefferson,
mm-hmm.
because when the young deputy comes back with the notebook, he tells him that he never thought of, never seen such a transformation of character, and this makes Grant realize that he's doing some good. If he did good there, maybe there's a chance of his doing some good in his school.
Mm-hmm.
Because before Jefferson is executed, he just felt that he was not doing anything at all. But after getting the notebook, and the young deputy tells how brave Jefferson was died, he began to realize that maybe I can do something. But it's a story about two young men growing, the growth, and they must take that responsibility. Jefferson must best take up some kind of responsibility, although he has only a few months to live, and then a few weeks, and then a few days. And Grant, who may have as many as 40 years to live, he must find a responsibility there, something to do with his life and for his family, for his community, and
We are a little bit past the midpoint here, and I must apologize. I had a caller, and I kept them waiting too long, and they hung up. And if they would like to call back, you're certainly welcome to do that. And, of course, anyone who was listening is welcome to call in and ask a question, make comments. And I should introduce again our guest, Ernest J. Gaines. He has written a number of books. The two probably that people will know him for would be his book, A Lesson Before Dying. That book was nominated for a Pulitzer Prize and won the National Book Critics Circle Award in 1994. In 1997, it was chosen by Oprah Winfrey to be one of the books in her book club. It is certainly available now in a paperback edition. It's published by Vintage. The other book that perhaps people will know is his book, The Autobiography of Miss Jane Pittman, which was published in 1971 and was his first big commercial success. That also was nominated for a Pulitzer Prize. His newest book is a collection of stories. It's titled Mozart and Leadbelly, a collection of stories and essays. That was published by Knopf last fall. So any and all of that you certainly should be able to find. He's received many different awards and a lot of recognition for his work, including the National Humanities Medal. Was awarded that by President Clinton back in December of 2000. He will be here in Champaign-Urbana to talk about his writing and about A Lesson Before Dying in part of a series that is a partnership between the Champaign Public Library and Parkland College, something they're calling the Literary Legends Series, and there'll be three writers who will be here. The first is Mr. Gaines. The second is Walter Mosley. He'll be here in May. And the third is Sherman Alexie. He will be here in June. And as I said at the beginning of the program, all of the tickets for Mr. Gaines' talk, which is next Wednesday, have been spoken for. However, on the website of the library, they do say that there is a waiting list. You can have your name put on there. And any tickets that are returned to the library, they'll be given to those people on the list. People also, by the way, can go to the Parkland College Theater where this is taking place on the night of the program. And anybody who doesn't show up will be those seats will be offered to other folks. But you certainly do have the opportunity also to hear Mr. Mosley and Mr. Alexie in the weeks ahead. So if you'd like to get more information about this, you go to the library website, Champaign Public Library. And here on the program, questions are welcome, 333-9455. Toll-free 800-222-9455. We're talking here a little bit about Lesson Before Dying and about these two characters and how the book is about the two of them, what happens to them, and how they change as a result of being together, sort of being thrown together. The thing really, though, that makes this happen, it's the two women. It's Grant's aunt and Jefferson's godmother. If it was not for them leaning on Grant, not for them saying, when he says, I don't want to have anything to do with this, they say, well, yes, you will. And I'm not sure which one of them says, if you think you're going to sleep under this roof ever again, you're going to do this. And of course, he's really angry and he doesn't want to deal with it. And he says, this is more than I can handle. I don't know how to do this. And as you say, he's teaching, but he hates it. He's living in the South. He doesn't like it. What he would really like most to do is just run away. Right. Take his girlfriend, who is actually married and not exactly completely free. What he'd like to do is take her and just run away from all this stuff that's too much for him to deal with. And were it not for these two women in his life, he might have done that, or at least
he would have done it.
He wouldn't be doing what they want him to do. So that just shows you how important these two characters are. And also certainly that one of the things that I believe is true is that, well, certainly that your aunt that raised you after your parents went to California, she was an important person in your life. She was the basis for Miss Jane Pittman. And there, no doubt, in these two women who are in this book, Miss Emma and Tante Lou, there must be a lot of your aunt in them.
My aunt is in all of these people. You know, when a lot of people have compared Miss Jane Pittman to my aunt. My aunt was crippled. My aunt never walked a day in her life. She crawled over the floor, and we children at work with along with her. For example, she could cook our food, but we had to bring all the stuff to this stove, with this old wood-burning stove. She washed our clothes. We had to bring the water, the old wash tub, because they didn't have a washing machine or anything like that. The old wash tub and the washboard and the soap, and she could sit on a little bench and brace herself against the tub and the rim of the tub and wash the clothes. She patched out clothes. She did all kinds of things. She would crawl over the floor, crawl across the porch, out into the garden because we had a little vegetable garden beside the house, as most people had on this plantation. And she'd work among her vegetables. So I gave this kind of strength, this kind of determination, this kind of spirit, to my character, to Miss Jane Pittman, and to most of my elderly ladies like Tonlu and Miss Emma. But many of these people, for example, Miss Jane Pittman tried to walk from Louisiana to Ohio when she heard about freedom from slavery. My aunt could not walk anywhere. And these other women I've had are always moving about. My aunt could not. Those people used to come to our house and visit. And my aunt would sit on the floor, and they would sit in a chair, and sometimes they would sit on the floor too. And talk to her, and that's where I got this idea of this strength of from my aunt to give to my female characters.
Yeah,
but none of my characters are based entirely on her.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. The one story that I read that just impressed me with the strength of this woman, your aunt, was that as you say that you had to, she could cook, but you had to get the stuff and bring
right.
it to her.
Right.
You had to do these things. That when it came time, when somebody was in trouble, when it came time for somebody to be punished, she actually sent you out to cut a switch,
yeah,
which
right.
you then dutifully did. Went out there, did it, and brought it back to her so that she could give somebody a couple of whacks. And
well,
I don't know.
I had to do it quite a few times. And so did my brother. Did it quite a few times. We'd go back and get the switch. and she wanted a proper length, proper size, and then we'd come back and get down on our knees in front of her and let her, whip us. But we understood, though, that, you know, that was, she was supposed to when we, you know, we did something wrong. We accepted that.
So the idea never occurred to you to say, no, I'm not going to go out and cut the switch and then bring it back here and let you whoop me. Not going to do it.
No. We could have got over a lot of trouble with uncles and other people who could have been rougher on us than my aunt was. If we disobeyed her at any time, we could never, ever, ever disagree with her, disobey her. No.
You know, one of the things about a lesson before dying, I think, that really impresses me is your approach to dialogue, which, and the thing that impresses me, that it's very straightforward, very natural, that, sometimes you read dialogue that that writers write, and it can be very elegant, and you could appreciate their skill at writing, but then you say to yourself, well, I can't really imagine anybody saying that. It's not, that isn't the way people talk. And I think perhaps maybe one of the reasons that a couple of your books have been successfully adapted for dramatic presentation, for film and for the stage, is that the dialogue works that very well that way. I'm sure that if you were a screenwriter, you could just take big chunks of what you wrote. You wouldn't need to do anything to it. You could give it to the actors, and they could without any difficulty put that across in a way that would say, yes, I believe that people actually do talk like that. And I'm interested in how you think about that, how it is you write for your characters what they have to say.
Well, I just try to recall how what I've heard on this area where I lived, and how people actually spoke. When I was writing my books, all of my books have been written in San Francisco. Mm-hmm. Everything I've ever written was written in San Francisco, but I was always coming back to Louisiana during that time, over a period of 40 years, to be and to listen, and to just be around the people, and I could always catch up on the way that they spoke, the little nuances and the limited dialogue in which they spoke. It was never too difficult for me to do. Someone asked me how difficult it was to write Jefferson's diary, and I said that it was not difficult at all, because by the time I came to the diary, I had been in that jail with Jefferson for 5 years, so I knew everything about him, how he would express himself, the words he would choose, what he would think about, and that's what I try to do with all my characters, whether they are very well educated or not educated at all. How would a person try to express himself? And I hope that you or any reader will see that different characters speak. Not all my characters speak alike. Mm-hmm. That those who are educated speak much different from those who are not. The older characters speak differently from younger ones. The person with religious background speak different from the people who don't go to church or attend church. So, I guess you get that from just listening to people and being around people and talking to them. And I still do that even to this day. I know a lot of people who don't, never finish school, any kind of school. So whenever I would come back from California, I would visit those people and listen to them and talk to them and ask them questions. And they were very, they because I'd come from this place, this plantation where they still lived. They were more than happy to talk to me about their lives and whatever questions I had to ask them.
Mm-hmm. The next writer who's going to follow you in the series was Walter Mosley.
Mm-hmm.
And I've had an opportunity to talk with Mr. Mosley a couple of times. Never met him, I'm sorry to say. They've been like conversations like this. It's been on the telephone.
Mm-hmm.
I've talked with him a couple of times and have read some of his work. And people maybe have read the series of mystery novels about this character named E.Z. Rawlins that he has done. A character who in the first book, the first time the reader encounters him, this is just in the period right after World War II.
Mm-hmm.
And then over time, Mr. Mosley has written a number of these stories that then move forward in time. And I think the last time I talked to him, I said, is E.Z. Rawlins going to see the year 2000? And he sort of chuckled a little bit and said, yes, he thought at least the character would, he'd bring the character pretty much up to the present day. But one of the things that is a consistent theme in a lot of his writing, and certainly in these stories, is the experience of being a black man in America. And what is very striking that you just can't get away from is that in this character's experience, over time, when you go from World War II, where these stories start, to some of the more recent ones that I think at least are maybe in the set in the time of the book, or in the 70s, is that things really haven't changed very much. You've written a book here, Lesson Before Dying, is set in 1948.
Yes.
Right? And I wonder what your thoughts are on that same subject, because indeed that this book is very much about at least what conditions would have been like, what it was like to be a black man in the South, in Louisiana, during the time of Jim Crow,
mm-hmm.
before the civil rights era. Do you think, how much have things changed? Or would you say that in a lot of ways, things haven't changed very much from that time to this?
Well, you know, the French saying that more things change, more things remain the same. When I left Louisiana in 1948, I could not go to a high school in this area. But when I came back to teach in 1981 at the University of Louisiana Lafayette, I was made writer in residence there. And, before I left here, I could not have gone into that university. The only way I could have gotten into that university was with a bucket and a mop and a broom, you know, to clean up the place after the white students had gone home. But then when I came back, I was writer in residence at the university. So those kind of things had changed. However, at the same time, I was made writer in residence at the University of Louisiana. We had a guy here running for Senate, a Nazi, and also running for governor of the state of Louisiana. And over 50% of people, over 50% of the white people in the state of Louisiana, voted for him for both as a U.S. senator as well as for governor of the state of Louisiana. And the only reason why he lost both of those races, because at least 40% of the whites voted against him and all the blacks voted against him. So those are the kind of changes you've had. 40 years ago, 50 years ago, he would have been a senator or a governor of the state. You have those changes. There are changes. There are jobs. You go to any hotel you wish. You go to the casinos all over the place. you go to the restaurants, all of the schools, most of the schools, and all of the universities are, of course, integrated. You may not have all the books and the teachings and the in these universities that you should have there, but there are many changes there. I'm not saying that it's completely changed. No, there's lots of things to happen yet, but we do have some changes, mm-hmm. both in academically as well as socially and politically. Things are changing.
It strikes me that A Lesson Before Dying is basically an optimistic book in the sense that it says that a kind of personal transformation, the thing that happens to happens to the two characters, happens to Grant and Jefferson. And I see it as optimistic because it says that kind of personal transformation is possible,
mm-hmm.
And that they do change in ways that initially, earlier on, probably neither of them would have believed that would have been possible.
Well, you have to include Paul in there, too. You know, I think there's a transformation in Paul. Because when he tells Grant that I will never forget this day when Jefferson is executed. This book, I've been asked, could you write a sequel to this book? And I said, of course, I cannot. I've never tried to write a sequel to anything. But that book took place, that story happened 6 years before, school desegregation in the South. And if I were to write a sequel, I think that sequel would include Paul as well as Grant and Vivian.
Mm-hmm.
And that I think there would be, working together there. So you're right, optimistic in that Grant had reached a point where he could become a good teacher and possibly a leader. And, of course, he had Vivian there, and I think Paul would have gone along with him as well. So I had those kind of things in mind when I finished the book, but of course there will not be a sequel to it.
Mm-hmm. These are people who have read the book and liked it and asked you, would you ever write a sequel?
Yes, right. Yes.
Yesterday on the program here, as it happens, I was talking with another writer and a Mexican author who was here visiting the campus, who has written a number of novels and only one of which is available in English, so unless you read Spanish, you can only read this one book of his. We were talking about writing, and he said something interesting, and because I was, we were talking about what he was looking for in a reader and why it is he writes, and he said that just as a kind of experiment, he had at one point asked a number of his friends who are also writers, he said to them, if you knew that no one would ever read anything you wrote, would you still write? And he said it was interesting because some of the people that he talked to said, well, yes, I would. And he said for himself, he wasn't sure. He wasn't sure what the answer to that question would be. He didn't have an answer. And now, having had that conversation with him, and now that I have the opportunity to talk with you, now I'm interested in asking you the same question. Let us say that you knew that no one had ever read anything that you wrote again, would you still write?
Well, first place, I'm not doing too much writing right now at all.
Well, during the time when you can put yourself back in the frame of mind when you were writing, was it the kind of thing where you were, it was so much a matter of, you were so compelled to write that you would do it whether anybody read it or not?
That I don't know. I really don't know. I depended on my writing to support me one day, that it would support me one day. During the time I was struggling to be a writer, or struggling to be published, I took all kinds of different jobs because I knew at that time, I believed that it would be I could write a book that could be published. So at that particular time, no, I would not have given up my writing. That was for many, many years. I graduated from San Francisco State in 1957, and I gave myself 10 years to prove whether or not I could write. I published my first book about 7 years after that, in 1964. And that was Catherine Cormier, which nobody read, I'm sure. There's only 25 copies were, 2,500 copies were, 2,500 copies were, well, I think it, no. 3,500 copies were published, or printed, and 2,500 of them were sold. 10,000 went on to remainder. I continued to write because I felt that I had something that I wanted to say. And 3 years later, I would publish my second novel of Love and Dust and began to get some attention from critics and my colleagues and book reviews. And you know. So I was going to continue to write no matter what at that particular time, mm-hmm. because I always felt that I could reach a point where somebody would read the books. I think if I were to feel that nobody would ever read my books, I probably would continue to write. Just put it there. However, I don't think how much time I would put into the writing. Mm-hmm.
Well, you know, we have used our time, so we're going to have to stop. I want to thank you very much for talking with us. We certainly appreciate it.
You know, this has been wonderful. I just wish I had a better voice today than I have, but I didn't realize it would be for a whole hour.
Oh, well, my apologies. I'm sorry. Well, I particularly am glad that you hung in there.